was the best Christmas present Joey ever gave me. We'd been together about 2 or 2.5 years when we got ready to record the first album. We were poised to strike. I had 9 years of being a hippie behind me, smoking pot, going to the village, reading Auspensky, and wanting to bust out of my own placenta, eggshell, or wherever the fuck I came from. When I wrote the music to Seasons of Wither, I grabbed the old acoustic guitar Joey found in the garbage on Beacon Street with no strings. I put 4 strings on it, which is all it would take because it was so warped, went to the basement, and tried to find the words to match the scat sounds in my head, like automatic writing. The place was a mess, and I moved all the shit aside, put a rug down, popped 3 tunnels, snorted some blow, sat down on the floor, tuned the guitar to that tuning, that special tuning that I thought I came up with. Loose-hearted lady, sleepy was she, love for the devil brought her to me. Seeds of 1,000 drawn to her sin, seasons of wither holding me in. One of the highlights of my career was being in Greenwich Village with Mark Hudson and coming across a guy sitting on a rag playing a guitar. His feet were black from the streets he'd walked. He looked up at me and starts playing Seasons of Wither, note for note, exactly as I wrote it. Someone was looking at my painting. Mama Kin was a song I brought with me when I joined Aerosmith. The lick for Mama Kin was from an old Bloodwind Pig song, See My Way. If Mick can say, oh, we got Stray Cat Blues from Heroin on the Velvet Underground's first album, I can cop to a little larceny on our part. Keep in touch with Mama Kin. Tell her where you've gone and been, living out your fantasy, sleeping late and smoking tea. Route 66 was our Stones mantra, a way of finding our groove. It was the riff I asked the band to play again and again in the basement of BU to show them what tight playing meant. When I started rehearsing with a jam band, we jammed as good as anyone, but to survive the rock and roll world, we'd have to write songs and get under the hood. That's why I had Aerosmith play that lick from Route 66 over and over and over until we were as tight as a midget's fist. We played it so many times, it eventually morphed into the melody for Somebody on our first album. One Way Street was written at the piano at 1325 with a rhythm and harp coming from Midnight Rambler. On Moving Out, the first song I wrote with Joe, you can hear him quoting Jimi Hendrix's Voodoo Child. He quotes the Beatles and the Stones elsewhere on the record. The rhythm of Write Me, originally Bite Me, came from something Joey was playing, but the intro comes from the Beatles' Gotta Get You Into My Life, because at that point, we didn't know how to write hooks. Dream On was the only song I hadn't finished by the fall of 72. So I moved to the Hilton at the airport in Boston while we were doing sessions at Intermedia Studios for the first album. I just buckled down one night and wrote the rest of the lyrics. And I remember reading them back and thinking, where did I get that from? It's strange rhymage. I loved Ema Sumac, the Inca princess with the staggering 5-octave voice. Look in the mirror, the past is gone. That vocal swoop? That's the Ema Sumac vocal swoop. Singers generally don't go from the bridges to the chorus with a bridge note like that, but it worked melodically for me. It's like the Isley Brothers singing It's Your Thing, where after the solo, the first line of the verse is sung an octave higher, then slides down an octave for the next. I would sing along with Ema Sumac, that eardrum-piercing banshee shriek, beginning in the highest register. She sang these strange, otherworldly songs in movies like Secret of the Incas and looked like an over-the-top Hollywood version of an Inca queen. Sam, Dave, and Sumac, an inspirational trinity. In October 1972, we started work on our first album at Intermedia Sound. It took only a couple of weeks to record because we'd been playing many of the songs, especially the covers, for over a year. Adrian Barber, an English engineer who'd worked with Cream and Vanilla Fudge, produced the album. It was recorded on very primitive equipment, 16-track to AGFA 2-inch oxide tape. The band was very uptight. We were so nervous that when the red recording light came on, we froze. We were scared shitless. I changed my voice into the Muppet Kermit the Frog to sound more like a blues singer. Kermit Tyler. I would unscrew the light bulb so no one would know we were recording. One of my favorite things to say before we recorded a song was, play it like you would if no one's looking, guys. They'd be recording and we'd be so nervous, making mistakes and hesitating, and I'd go, fuck being nervous, just play. We would run through the song live a couple of times, then Adrian would shout, yes, it's got fire, it's got the bloody fire. As soon as we'd cut that first song, Make It, upon listening to playback, I knew we'd nailed it. I'd done Sun at some studio in New York and all that shit. Sun was stiff and forced, but I knew that with this band, once we got out of our own way, we were going to ace it. And with a great guitar player like Joe in the band, if we stayed true to our fuck all, everything would sound like Aerosmith. I used an exaggerated black-speak voice on all the tracks except Dream On. I thought it was really cool. The only problem was, nobody knew it was me. I sang like this because I didn't like my voice, and it was early on and I wanted to put on a little. To this day, some people still come up to me and ask, who's that singing on the first album? I was into James Brown and Sly Stone and just wanted to sound more R&B. Dream On deserved strings, but we couldn't hire an orchestra on the kind of budget we had for our first record, so I used a Mellotron to fill out the sound. It was like an early sampling device employed by the Beatles. I used it to add strings and flutes to Dream On while doing lines off my keyboard. I thought the Mellotron would do the trick coming in on the second verse. In the end, we decided not to use Major Barbara and did Rufus Thomas's Walking the Dog via Stones instead, which was tighter than a crab's ass from doing it in the clubs for so many years. On the first 10,000 copies of the album, they spelled it Walking the Dig. If you happen to find a copy, it's worth about $5,000. You'd figure with all the cash and power the labels had, they'd learn how to spell. That, coupled with the fact that Dream On didn't come out until after the second album, made me think, if things didn't go down, we wouldn't go up. I believe in life imitating art, but who is art, and why is he imitating me anyway? Of all the songs I wrote on that first album, One Way Street has some of my favorite lyrics. You got 1,000 boys, you say you need them, you take what's good for you, and I'll take my freedom. The original title was Tits in a Crib. That's what I wanted to call it, but that was 40 years ago when things weren't as loose as they are today. I wrote it about this girl I was seeing. I'd talk her into coming over because she was such a trip. Did me so good. She had a baby, and when she came over, she'd bring the kid and his crib, saying, I have no babysitter tonight. She used to fuck me to death in that crib. The line, you got 1,000 boys, you say you need 'em, came from where we were living at the time, in Needham, Massachusetts. I'll do anything for a rhyme. I can't think of that girl's name now, but God, she was the skinniest, cutest little trollop. The style of the first album was raw, filled with relentless attitude. We were a bunch of boys who had never seen the inside of a recording studio. You can practically hear our hearts racing on every track. Barber's atmospheric technique resulted in tracks that were so open, you could literally feel the tracks breathing. It was almost transparent. We knew the road was where we could conquer. Sure, it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but we wanted to add one more word to the equation. Ginormous. We needed to get to the people, so we did it ourselves. Played every small town and went to every station in the fucking country. Sure, it's old school, but it worked. Aerosmith was all about sex. Music for hot chicks and horny boys. Loud, bone-rattling rock for chopped and channeled cars and customized Harleys. If you're driving along and you hear Moving Out, you're gonna go, I want to get the fuck out of here and dance. Roll the window down and let the world in on your little secret. Well, the gist of Aerosmithism is cars plus sex, booty shake music, we rock like a bitch, Cream, April 1973, wrote, Aerosmith is as good as coming in your pants at a drive-in at age 12, with your little sister's babysitter calling the action. Okay, at least somebody out there was getting us. We spent the whole of the 1970s on tour. It was just one long, endless road trip. We'd stay out on the road for a year and a half. The only time we'd come off the road was to record an album. We went out with everybody. Mott the Hoople, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, the Kinks. We toured the Midwest that debut LP summer in a couple of limos with the two guys from Buffalo and Kelly, our new road manager. Robert Kelly Kelleher. Our first real tour was opening for the Mahavishnu Orchestra. John McLaughlin, in his white robes, burning incense, spreading his transcendental six-string scent. Sweet. We opened for the Kinks in the Northeast and Midwest. Ray Davies called us Harry Smith after the hair on Kelly's back. We were opening for bands that were our heroes. Ian Hunter from Mott sang like no one else did. Groups that were beginning to fade a bit and whose audiences we wanted. We used to do out-of-town shows with Mott the Hoople. We'd make up to $500 a night with them. To save on getting there, we'd use these bogus DUSA, Discover USA tickets that were like 50% off. You were supposed to be a non-American passport holding tourist to get them, but we found this travel agent who helped us out. Then I'd go up to the counter with an English accent. Hello, we'd like to pre-board. Or whatever the fuck it was, that's how we were able to do that. Then we'd come home and play every high school in the area and little neighborhood colleges. We'd throw $1,000 at the athletic fund and we'd do everything else. And they'd give us the four walls, meaning we'd make all the money. It soon became a little status thing. Oh, Aerosmith played at our high school. And then Wrentham High, and then the Zavarian Brothers out in Westwood. And everybody wanted to have Aerosmith play at their school, and we pretty much did. We did it at our high school, too, and at BC, Boston College. At the Q Forum at BC, that was when I knew the band had made it. The crowd was so huge and out of control. Meanwhile, our father Frank is in the hockey team dressing room with father so-and-so getting him drunk. Ah, those were the days. Because there were so many people that we were almost afraid to go on. We went into the bathroom with a security guard, Johnny O'Toole, outside the door. The kids were throwing chairs through the bathroom window and climbing in the window, ripping the back doors off the arena, just blowing the windows out of the place, trying to get into this hockey rink, which they did. So we ran out of there and went down a hallway. Boston College, 1973. There were so many people, a real freak show. Sometime in 73, this guy Tony Forgione said, I'm going to open a club. It was the old Frank and Ike supermarket where Eric Clapton and Joey Kramer had played years ago and asked us to headline. Al Jakes was around and all those goofy guys from Frank Connolly's old crew in Framingham. We had Billy Squire and the Sidewinders open for us. The fire department was there and they'd posted a certain capacity. Here's how we're going to do it, I said. We're going to fuck them up tonight. When you've got that many people coming in, you estimate the crowd by the median between three clickers. We had three different clickers between us, but the count is always jive because someone somewhere is always on the take. When we were doing it, we'd count every third person coming in. We stuffed that club. We opened one night, and the fire department closed us down the next night. The club never opened again, and we took all the money. Steamroll. Alyssa Jarrett, who married Joe Perry, remained unbelievably gorgeous. Everyone was in love with her. She'd been Chicago guitarist Joe Jammer's girlfriend, had gone to England, worked as a high-fashion model, had dinner at Jimmy Page's house at Pangbourne on Thames, and all that. She felt this patina of uber-hipness had rubbed off on her. On the road, we played Dream On every night. I thought that was the song that defined me. But not everyone shared my passion for that ballad. Every time we started to play Dream On, Alyssa would roll her eyes and go, oh, fuck, not this song again. God, let's go snort some blow. She'd make sure I saw her, and all the guys in the crew followed her in the bathroom. While she was cutting up lines, it cut me to the core. It broke my heart. It was the song that hurled us to wherever we are today and beyond. Born somewhere between the Red Parachute and my dad's piano, that song took this band to places where we could only dream on. Back in the early days before we'd had a hit on the radio, we made our reputation playing live and loud. As an opening act, we'd only get to play three or four songs, so if we wanted to strut our stuff, slow songs weren't what we'd play. You'd do the hard and heavy down and dirty to get your ya-yas out. Joe didn't like Dream On from the start, didn't like the way he played. He felt we were a hard rock band, and here we were staking our reputation on a slow ballad. And to Joe, rock and roll was all about energy and flash. When it was first released in 1973, Dream On only made it to 59 in the Hot 100 chart. But you know, the song got bigger and bigger, and I got my ta-da moment. When it got re-released in 1975, it went to number 6 in the charts. I got a Grammy for it, but I would gladly have traded any gold album just to have my brother love that song. Wait a minute. I take that back. The concerts were getting more rowdy and outrageous. We opened on August 10th, 1973 for Sha Na Na at Suffolk Downs Racetrack near Boston. 35,000 kids showed up and got so rowdy they had to stop the show. All right, now that was more like it. Aerosmith had been big in Detroit from the beginning. We had a loud, flashy, gritty, metallic vibe. Rolling Stone called us greasers, wrench rock, which was strange because we looked more like medieval troubadours. We were hardly grease monkeys, mechanics of ecstasy, maybe. But they did love us in the Rust Belt towns. Toledo, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Detroit. The only part of us that was heavy metal was the clang of steel. The body shop, assembly line, car-based clamor. We're a people's band. Judy Carne, the English comic who starred in the iconic TV show Laugh-In and dated Joe for a stint in the early 70s, thought we were the voice of the mills and the malls. And those working-class towns were the places that embraced us early on. We had to get out there, however we could, to the fans. We knew that the energy we had was contagious, that we would infect the whole colony. Evidence that we were getting through came when we started pulling Mott the Hoople's audience. Kids started jumping over the barriers, climbing on stage, and grabbing at us. Detroit was the turning point for us. We played Cobo Hall 3 times in 75. After that, we exploded. There's a ton of bands out there competing for the hearts, minds, and bucks of the sacred rock fan, but Aerosmith has managed, for better or worse, to get to the ear, and various other organs, of a lot of them. Still, our core audience was always the Blue Army, the hardcore kids from the Midwest. They were the Blue Army because they all wore denim jeans. The place was a sea of blue. Just like when you go see Jimmy Buffett and his Parrothead contingent. Look out, it's Q-Tip Nation. Everyone's fucking gray, and they love it. And we all got to ride that Aerosmith train to the outer reaches. Our interest was the same as the kids, rocking out, getting them off, getting us off. Like I always inquire, was it as good for you as it was for me? Inspires a quick verse. Was it as good for you as it was for me? That smile upon your face makes it plain to see. What I got, what you got, ooh-wee. So was it as good for you as it was for me? Chapter 5, Confessions of a Rhymeaholic. When I was in my late teens, 17 or 18, I used to come home from one-night stands with local New Hampshire bands like Click Horning and Twitty and Smitty and crash at Tro Rico, fucked up on trashy skunk New England weed. I began to write a song on an old Estee pump organ about alienation. The ancient Victorian instrument, made in Vermont in 1863, lived in the studio where my dad practiced piano 4 hours a day. In order to play on the pump organ, I'd have to sneak time during the day while the guests were swimming at Dewey Beach. The song started with a melody in my right hand that rocked back and forth hypnotically out of the ether. That was Dream On. I began it in F minor with a C, C-sharp discord. That gave it a haunting Edgar Allan Poe kind of feel. I wrote much of the body of the song in Sunapee, where I knew I had something. The verses were composed at the Logan Hilton when we were working on our first album. I've always said it's about hunger, desire, ambition, a song to give to myself. Something about it was nostalgic and familiar, as if it'd been written by someone else years before. But if no one has, then you know you're into something. Or perhaps like I had written it years later and was looking back on all the things that have happened to me over the last 4 decades. Pink, off 9 Lives, felt that way, like it was somebody else's. However interpreted, my primordial thought was that maybe I wasn't put here on Earth just to mow lawns. Every time that I look in the mirror, all these lines in my face getting clearer. The past is gone. Stream of consciousness mixed with the Grimm's fairy tales my mother read to me from the crib till I had to read them to myself. Sing with me. Sing for the years. Sing for the laughter and sing for the tears. Sing with me If it's just for today, maybe tomorrow the good Lord will take you away. The lyrics to Dream On came in a thought, and my train of thought stops at every station. By pure crazy chance, last summer I found the very organ on which I'd written Dream On, in a house on the Lake Road near where I live. That road has become for me a kind of metaphor for my life. Beginning in the woods near my house, I remember the days I'd be up in Sunapee at the start of winter, really scared in the dark and not knowing what to do with my life. And then farther on, the road winds down to the harbor where Joe and I used to hang. The road forms a loop, a 3-mile jog that meanders past houses quaint and grand, beside grassy green fields, up and down grades. I would make the trek every morning for 2 months to prime myself for any upcoming tour. Nobody would ever guess that I get the breath to sing Don't Want to Miss a Thing in fucking Russia from running this friggin' loop. If I can make it up Heartbreak Hill, down into the harbor, and back up to the house still in one heart-pumping, breathless peace, I'd be ready for the campaign. Sometimes I'd run right off the end of the dock into the water, anointed by the waters of Mother Nature, baptized by freezing Lake Sunapee. In live performance, before I go and sing that high note and Dream On, I do a little hyperventilating. I look down, like this, use your imagination. And I breathe in and out, rapidly. Then I go, yeah, and I hold my breath where anyone else, if they were underwater, would be going, I gotta come up for air. I learn how to go past that in part by making those treks around the lake for the sake of holding the note. Over the last 10 years, as the condition of my feet has deteriorated from stomping stages since the 70s, the loop has become more and more challenging, but more on the wounded rock warrior later. One night, during a non-aerobic stroll on the loop, I passed a house that was glistening with a flickering flame inside. The house was called Witch Way. Outside, there were gargoyles and mannequins and twisty limbs from trees. I'd seen this house many times before, and every time I went past it, I'd go, I'd love to meet the person who lives there. I'd stop out front and yell, hello, I love you in there. This time, I shouted a little louder, and a sweet middle-aged couple, Sherry and Philip, invited me in. Philip's a contractor, Sherry is a sculptor. Amazing, bizarre stuff she's made is all over the house. Oh my God. I say, can I look around? A sculpture made out of a cello, another one, I can barely describe it, made out of gourds and dried sunflowers. It looked like the Wizard of Oz. Meanwhile, on a huge flat-screen TV, America's Got Talent is on the tube. 20 girls that any guy would love to do. In the front room, there's an old organ, just like the one on which I'd written Dream On. I began playing and felt like I was levitating. The organ felt very familiar. I was transported back to Trorico all those years ago when I grabbed a few chords out of the air. Turns out, it was an Estee pump organ made in Vermont in 1863, the exact type we had up at Trorico. Where'd you get this? I asked. There was an old antique store down at the harbor right across from the community store, and the organ was sitting out on the porch, she explained. So they'd bought it in the 80s, which would have been about the time my dad sold Trorico. Talk about serendipity. I'm called by my muse into a house that I'd never been inside, and there's my old friend, the Dream On pump organ. Was it possible? I sat down, laid my hands upon the keys, and pulled out all the F-stops as I did 35 years ago. As I started pumping the organ, I could feel her start to breathe. We made musical love right then and there. Sherry said she bought the organ at an auction in Sunapee the fall after my parents sold Trorico, and that it's most likely the same organ. I think the organ has a poltergeist in it that somehow attached to the crystal vase, she told us. I'd always kept this little crystal vase on top of the organ, but after we moved, I decided to put it on the bookshelf. One night, I was sitting on the floor drawing when this vase came off the shelf and hit me in the back, you know? But since I put it back on the organ, it hasn't done it in 9 years. I made Sherry promise me that if she ever sells that organ, she'll let me make the first offer. It's the shit. It really truly is a pump organ with all the stops. Talk about my train of thought that makes all the stops. Not as many stops as the pump organ I wrote my first hit on. A strange thing about antiques. They had another life before we get introduced to them. It's like an ancient string of beads that you might find in Mesopotamia. You don't know who they could have belonged to. They tell you only these are beads from the ancient lands found in the ruins, or they were found in a barnacle-encrusted chest off the coast of the Holy Land. Did they once hang around Mary Magdalene's neck? When a song comes to you and you write it in 10 minutes, you think, there it is, dropped in our laps like a stork dropping a baby. It was always there, the song, on the inside. I just had to get rid of the placental crap that was around it. Because at the end of the day, who really wrote that? If Dylan were here, he would tell you in his laid-back bobness,
well, now where would it come from?
Out of the blue, lines come to you. You think you're in love like it's a real sure thing. But every time you fall, you get your ass in a sling. You say you're in love, but now it's, ooh, baby, please. 'Cause falling in love is so hard on the knees. You see it floating there and say, this should be caught. It's like those Native American dream catchers. I look at those and go, oh my God, that's my fucking brain. I would see something or hear Joe playing. I'd yell, whoa, whoa, what was that? Or a passage in a Beach Boys song where they go to the bridge and I'll hear an entire song in there. When I was a kid, my mom would read me all these stories and poems, Dickens and Tennyson and Emily Dickinson. That's where I got my rhyming from. I'm a rhymeaholic. It made me curious in life to wonder why, when you look out the back window of your car and you stop for a red light, the world seems to be coming back at you. Everything you pass catches up to you. Poems from the past can turn into songs in the present through curiosity and imagination. But it catches up to you, like when I had dreams about flying or floating up to the ceiling, then out the window and over a city. I'd have a piece of wood, be on a hill, slap it to my chest, and I'd catch winds like a sled does snow, and start lifting up, and I'd fall and roll down the hill, and I'd grab it again, and catch the winds, and be afraid I'd fall down again, and get back up, and those winds would blow me out to sea. I'd go so high, and find myself in a tree, and I'd wake up going, are there cars that levitate? I'd feel that sensation in my chest like when you fall. The stories inspired the dreams, so thank you, Mom, for the stories. I was twizzling the little skull I have twined in my braid and went, I started off with something that everyone's familiar with, like a line from Dream On. Every time I look in the mirror, all these lines on my face getting clearer. Sing with me. Sing for the years. I'll grab a little of that and throw it in like yeast. It's 2010, and if I was to connect the dots from Dream On till now, I would say, all the lines on my face as I sang for the years. Was the skull in my braid barely down to my ears? I could deal with the screaming, you know how that goes. When the skull in my braid hung down to my nose. And you get the rhythm going, and in no time at all, it's writing itself. I'll have had me a pint and be hanging with Keith when the skull in my braid's grown down to my teeth. If I'm not on tour, well, you know where I've been when the skull in my braid's grown down to my chin. When the agents and labels get round to a check, that old skull in my braid will be down to my neck. And I'll take that old check and I'll rip it to bits by the time my old skull has grown down to my tits. With my girl in the sun and I'll maybe get faced. When the skull in my braid's grown down to my waist, I'll be ripping it up with a mouthful of sass. When the skull in my braid's looking down at my ass. And life will be good, and life will be sweet, if that skull in my braid makes down to my feet. It's been second to none that no life can compare. When that skull in my braid gets cut out of my hair. Yesterday and today I was thinking about the timelines between the verse and the curse. Chorus, and how it all works together. There are four elements to writing a song, or as they say in comic book land, the fantastic four. If you break it down, there's melody, words, chords, and rhythm. Put those down in any order and you've got something you can play to piss your parents off. When I was married, I used to think of myself in the third person. I would say to my wife, well, I can't believe you're married to this guy in a band, you know? How could you do that? Then a couple of years ago, my daughter Liv called me up and said she was marrying Royston, another guy in a band. There it was again. Like a shadow, you know? My ex-wife called me last night, and I thought, well, you know what? I love her. And she's picking up my son, and I'm thinking about my girlfriend Erin and the girlfriends I've had in life, where I've been, two divorces and stuff, all fodder for the passionate pen. If you have a child with a woman, you'll understand that when you write a song with somebody, it's like having a child with them. You're birthing. You're evoking the spirits of a moment in time. Specific moments. Seconds. So for better or worse, I'd come up with a scat. Trying to make sense of it all. First it's, hey Jaded. Which later on in a magic moment turns into, hey Jaded. Which puts it in a very rhythmic meter with a 4-4 time signature. It's a picture of my temperament set to music. Once you have a melody, that's your hat rack. A hat rack that can hold many hats. The hats are the words you throw on top of it. Or you can scat, and by scatting, summon up lyrics. Once you have lyrics, you can let the words come up with melody. Those lines, back when Cain was Abel, way before the stable, from Adam's apple. You know where those came out of? Scatting. I would listen back, along with the rough of the song, and I would hear lyrics, every time. Tapped right into my own subcontinent. It would jump right out at me from the scat. I could play you scats, and if you listen close enough, you would hear the lyrics that I wrote, not unlike psychoacoustics. If two people are playing, you hear things in the middle. If two notes are played or people are singing, there is a tone on the in-between. Harmonic slash psychoacoustic slash vibe. The scat kink became pink. The scat to the Beatles classic Yesterday was Scrambled Eggs. Fucking magic. You take off from there. You don't know what you're singing or what chord it is. It's all done as if you're in the middle of a desert with two long poles and a lot of little sticks. The people from the town come out and they're wondering how you got up there, how you climbed up the palm tree on the rungs of your own voice and the lyrics you wrote. Oh my God, look at that. He's singing. How did he get up there? You build a ladder. A song is a kind of ladder too, but that you've got to build without little sticks. Never mind the melody, never mind the chords. No, no, no. You start with infatuation, obsession, passion, anger, zeal, craze. Then take a handful of notes, sew them into a chord structure, create a melody over that, and then come up with words that fit it perfectly. Oh my God, what is that? He's up there singing and he climbed up on air on his vocal cords. Well, yeah, I got up there on my own nasty scat. It's a deep dish apple pie, baby. You know right away if a song has that magic. It has to have those extremes. The one thing it can't be is okay. Okay is death. Okay is a jingle or a ringtone. Not even that. You look at the person you're writing with and say to yourself, God, this is going to be either great or suck. Dare ya. Those are the only two possible choices you got. There are a lot of musicians that are schooled and learned and playing piano in the bar at the Four Seasons or Days Inn, and they're really good. The problem is they never learn how to be really bad. See, when I go and sing a song with an artist like Pink, I say, oh man, I can fuck that song up good. It's a figure of speech for me, kind of my mantra, because that's what I do. I know I'm going to rip it a new asshole, and I'm going to take it big into the passionate pool. That's what I know how to do. Tom Hamilton, bless his fat strings and good heart, wasn't sitting in a room with the insight and forethought of going, fuck, who wrote those Kinks albums? I had that thought because I knew that he, Ray fucking Davies, wrote those records. Where did the invention come from? The flash from wherever to write a song and get a bunch of guys together to just start playing and maybe make a mistake and take that mistake, save it, and turn it into something you're proud of? Own your mistakes. Write something, sing something, as bad or good as it is, that no one has come up with. I sat with Joe and went, oh my God. We wrote a song after that riff he was playing and I jumped on it and it naturally became Moving Out. And that's how Dream On came to me. Natural. The voice inside never stops asking, What am I going to sing about? Questions upon questions. Why has Janie got a gun? What's my first verse? What's the third verse? What's the chorus and the pre-chorus going to sound like? How will the end go? What did her daddy do? It's Janie's last IOU. She's going to take him down easy and put a bullet in his head. Oh, my God. Now she's done it. Now it makes sense from the beginning. Sometimes I think I've given more forethought to that than to getting married, having kids, getting a driver's license, going to school, college. It transcends the everything because it is the everything. Songs are never in plain sight. They're under your skin. If anything, the best are peripheral, and then they pop out like a baby. Did I want to get that song out with its head crowning out of the vagina of the music? Yes! And in some cases, like Jaded, those breech birth song babies caused so big a disruption in my life that I endangered my marriage, squandered the time I should have spent with my children, just to get that song out. Chapter 6. Little Bo Peep, the Glitter Queen, and the Girl in the Yellow Corvette. Did women get backstage and offer themselves to us on our altar of lust? Take off their clothes, do tricks, satisfy our aching needs? Not in the beginning. Stuff like that doesn't happen on a regular basis until you become really, really famous. But still, were there ass-shaking trollops in the audience who defined our existence and made our minds go into glory hallelujah mode? Abso-fucking-lutely. Hell, that's what it's all about. Now, I'm not saying these girls didn't come backstage after performances. Of course they did. Isn't that why they showed up to begin with? Music was one thing, but my thing was the other. I'd run back and get Kelly. Kelly, the girl with the red dress in the front row, have her shaved and oiled and brought to my tent. And she'd be there. As dirty as my mind is, my body's pretty clean. Kelly always made sure the girls were in the shower when I got in the room. I liked my pulchritude pristine. I can't kiss a girl that's been stage diving with 500 other guys. I'm very oral, and I like clean. Back then, sure, you could have gotten gonorrhea, but with one shot of penicillin, see ya. Unlike today, STDs were a dime store dozen in those days. How do you avoid them? Screw them through saran wrap? Nah, if they washed, they were clean. As someone once said, you ain't seen nothing till you're down on a muffin, and I'm no different. After we became more famous, girls began coming backstage without having to be coaxed. Soon they started getting inventive, printing their own backstage passes for the price of a little backstage ass. But early on, there were no girls doing backflips, no limos, no private jets, just the occasional girlfriend of a band member who acted like the only thing they ever blew out was their hair. Of course, there were other pleasures of the road, like the girl in the yellow Corvette. Rewind to the summer of 1972, when we used to drive to our gigs in this truck that Mark Lehman owned, our original roadie and road manager all wrapped up in one. These days it's probably moldering in the woods with vines growing through it. Anyway, that's how we got to the gigs in the early days, and who wants to ride in a fucking van with the guys in the band? Sure, it's okay to ride together when you're on your way from Connecticut to New York to do a show. That's a mere 2 hours. You're all in the van together and you're psyched. You're getting buzzed from breathing in the eau de low tide of the night before, mixed with the sweet smell of sensimilla, stale cigarettes, and flat beer. To this day, it's an aphrodisiac like no other to me. But the long, endless road trips in that van with guys farting, telling lame jokes, pissing in pop bottles, that was murder. Somewhere in the grain belt between Indianapolis down to who knows where, I fell asleep on the top of the amps in the back of the van with my head staring out the window and my mind on Mars. I woke as the wheels rolled over half a deer that had been sliced in two the night before by a semi. We were doing 55 in our international harvester truck, christened the Good Ship Aerosmith, when I spied something yellow. It looked like a giant sour lemon drop, moving in retrograde in the next lane. My curiosity was instantly tweaked. I shouted to the driver, Mark, slow down, let that car we just passed catch up to us. Suddenly, I'm staring at a yellow Corvette bearing a blonde with gigantic orbs and a smile from heaven. I crawled up over the top of the amps, like an infantryman, on the beach at Iwo Jima, and landed on Joe's lap in the front seat. Joe goes, "What the fuck are you doing, Tyler?" "I'm just looking for a kiss," I say. "You ain't getting that from me," said Joe. "That's not what you said last night," I quipped. "You can't ever really get back at a guitar player. They'll just crank their amp up to a million and drown you out." She worked at the motel we'd stayed at the night before and was out on the highway doing a bit of her own randy reconnaissance. You can't always get what you want, but she knew if she tried hard enough, she could get her heart's desire, and that was lucky me. She took me to a room and fucked my brains out. It was like 3 a.m, and she rolls over and caresses my back. "What? Again? Oh, baby," I thought. But what I said was, "You know what? I could do this all night and the next day, but I gotta get up really early to catch this goddamn flight." "Well, we can take my Corvette," she says. "And tell you what, I'll sit on your lap and grind you to the middle of next week, or you can ride my face all the way to Chicago or wherever the hell we're going." It didn't matter. Time becomes meaningless in the face of creativity. Was I dreaming or the luckiest guy on earth? "That sounds okay to me," I said with all the casualness I could muster. "But first," she says, "I gotta go back home for a few minutes to put out some feed for the horses." "Oh yeah, I'm not in New York anymore." I end up back at her house, riding horses bareback all night, naked, right out of a storybook. Is this really happening? Am I dreaming, or am I being dreamed? Around 5 a.m., she says, "Put your clothes on. We're going." What the hell? I wanted to see the show anyway. If this ain't something I already put in a song, it sure as hell's gonna be. Well, the next gig was in Davenport, Iowa, and damned if we didn't drive that little Corvette all the way. 4 beautiful hours with mysterious fields of corn flashing by, rusty old gas stations, grain elevators, clapboard churches, and the sun's coming up. 2 months later, she's still on tour with me. The guys in the band, of course, are royally pissed. Why wouldn't they be? They're up there reading their in-flight magazines, drooling stewardess dreams, while I'm out there getting my kicks on Route 66. I swear to God, or General Motors, I never traveled so sweetly to this day. I only wish we were on the radio right now, or on Oprah. I would say, if you're out there, please call this number. I want to know how you are, what you're doing, and what you look like now. Of course, sometimes you don't want to know. You'd rather remember them the way they were, the way we all were. Later on, when fame comes, things change. We're in all the pop magazines and gossip columns. We're fucking celebrities, and we've got an impressive entourage of hot coke dealers and purveyors of other things for the discerning drug addict. Everybody wants to be my baby. Everyone wants to kiss my ass. "But isn't that what you always wanted, Steven?" my guardian angel in a pink bustier asks. "Hell yeah, baby. Whatever you say." But fame is a bitch. You probably heard that somewhere, but only because it's goddamn true. It's a riderless horse. It's a two-headed dog sniffing its own butt. A one-eyed cat peeking in a seafood store. And it's the absolute greatest generator of creative fiction there is. You make it up, then they make it up. And as soon as you get well-known enough for people to want to make stuff up about you, they will. It's not up to you anymore. The demon is on the loose. Everybody you work with, buy a car from, hire as a babysitter, everyone who fixes your computer, each becomes, overnight, a writer of short stories, a chronicler of mouth-watering scandal. Remember who we're talking about. Famous people. Why, they're capable of almost anything you can imagine. They're degenerate, ruthless, heartless, and disgusting, so pile it on. Anyone who's worked for Paul McCartney, believe me, has a story to tell. "Oh, I saw Macca massaging a stump." "Get out." "No, really?" Of course, it's all we ever wanted, to be famed and acclaimed. But be careful what you wish for, because fame is the bitch goddess of rumor, innuendo, slander, and gossip, and the perverted purveyor of tabloid trash. She'll say anything to anyone, anywhere. Psst, want to hear some real hot stories about Stephen what's-his-name, how he got there, and what he did to whom when he got there? It'll make your hair stand on end. And that's not all that'll stand on end, baby. Want to see some Paris Hilton-type sex tapes? Want to hear some nasty shit secretly recorded by his babysitter? I swear. Oh, yeah, that shit goes on. Tapes of the babysitter overhearing every private conversation you ever had with your children, bandmates, accountants, ex-wives, even your fucking proctologist. In the end, even the babysitter story makes you look like an asshole. Once you become a rock star, something you've prayed for fervently since you were 16, making promises to sleazy saints and strange goddesses of the night, all bets are off. After you're famous, it's all simple and brutal. You're either loved across the board for things you did do, or sneered at for things you didn't do, or vice versa. Either way, you become a dartboard for other people's fears, doubts, and insecurities. And right there in the bullseye are the two terrible tabloid twins, sex and drugs. Now, of course, the good stories, we claim proud ownership of those. As for all the rest, well, we don't read our own press. Wink, wink. But that's horse shit. One way or another, we eventually get to hear all the news that'll blow a fuse. If we don't read it, we're sure to hear it from girlfriends, mothers, fathers, or our best friends. Then there's the occasional, "Tyler's in room 221, written in smoky letters across the sky by a stunt pilot who found that we were staying at the Four Seasons in Maui, who got his info from the concierge, who got it from the bellboy, who got a phone call from the airline steward, who sent the call the second he saw your ugly face getting off the plane. Lend the family parrot to the town crier. No matter what you do, there's someone putting together a little bag of anecdotes in which you're prominently featured doing nasty stuff. If I get gas down at the corner, the woman who pumps my gas is going to be telling all her friends the next day, and the story will grow. Not only do I get my gas there all the time, but I get my car serviced there. And as a matter of fact, I had dinner over at her house the night before and watched American Idol with her and made popcorn. And if she happens to be good looking and your wife finds out, then you've automatically had an affair with this girl. That's Stevie, the kind of things he asks you to do. So go on, make it up. By now, Steven Tyler is pretty much a fictional character anyway. I have absolutely no control over the little fuck. I read about him, and I don't know who it is. Just the other day, I open a book, and what do I find? A former Aerosmith accountant, a perfectly reasonable, rational person, someone who adds up columns of figures, divides them, amortizes them, collateralizes them, has turned into a writer of bodice-ripper romances. She's telling a lurid tale featuring little old me. The woman's become an authority on my sex life. My dear, there's a little-known fact I'll share with you about Steven Tyler. Something that few people know. By this point, we're all holding our breath. We're spellbound. In a hoarse whisper, she continues. He makes his groupies put on kinky costumes. Oh, yes. He designs them himself. He makes them recite nursery rhymes while he fucks them. He can't get it up unless they're dressed up as Little Bo Peep, Little Miss Muffet, Little Red Riding Hood. What a perv that Steven is. And that was my accountant. Back to our story, already in progress. The band hits Warp Speed in the Midwest. At the helm, our driver, Mark Lehman, a one-man hump amp, rig light, setup, sound system wizard. When I saw Almost Famous, I said, holy shit, is this sideways Aerosmith or what? We were on that bus, in that plane, diving naked off rooftops into the way outosphere along with fellow demon Ted Nugent. The hallways were crowded with bad girls, seedy characters, and a waiter named Julio delivering groupies on a room service cart. Now, one night after our show at the Paramount Theater in Seattle in late November 1973, we're all in this big room backstage, and our very considerate promoter had invited these girls there for us. I've got a little surprise for you, boys. My, 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 what do I spy with my little eye? Six nubile young chicks, one cuter than the next. They curtsy and introduce themselves to the band. One says,
"Hello, boys. We're the Little Oral Annie Club."
"Well, beam me up, Scotty," says I.
Then she says,
"Well, sir, we've taught each other how to give great heads, so when we meet rock stars, we blow you like no man has been blown before."
To have two girls come up and say, "Hi, we'll do each other. Want to watch?" is mind-boggling. Six hot girls, and one of them whispers in your ear, "I can eat her pussy right here and now better than anyone on the planet." I think I can safely speak for all males of the species. This moment would have changed your religion. All these girls were dressed up fantasy style in sexy costumes. Guys are very predictable creatures. We all like schoolgirls in plaid skirts, women in high heels and fishnet stockings. Strawberry Fields, as she called herself, was their den mother. Kind of heavy set and a little older, but she knew what rock stars, hell, what all boys, wanted. As for the me that I thought I knew, he'd left the building. This woman knew. She knew how to take care of her girls and how to please the boys. Speaking of which, remember a little group of nasty girls called the Plaster Casters? They were originally two plaster casters, but soon more were needed. If Led Zeppelin were in town, say, and the first two girls were busy, well, that night they would send another couple of girls over to do the Allman Brothers. Eventually, there were more girls involved at each session, a plethora of plasterers. One cooked up the plaster, the second one did the fluffing, and the third one would cast the mold and put it in her easy-bake oven. I never had my plaster casted because I always believed in mystery meat. I figured if I got the cast, it would wind up on someone's mantelpiece somewhere and people would be going, "That's Steven Tyler's dick?" We'd lost half our audience right there. The girls are parading around in their outfits and I'm talking to Strawberry Field. She's got my attention and other parts of my anatomy too by now. And she's telling me all the stuff they do. Groupie geishas. I wanted to say, "As long as I've got a face, you'll always have a place to sit." But it came out, but what I meant to say was, So, you girls, you dress up in different outfits? I asked.
"Well, of course, we have any kind of costume you want," chimes Miss Fields. "Just tell me, we're here to please."
This was way before you could call a service and say, "Send over a couple of hookers dressed up like Jack Sparrow and Whoopi Goldberg." Strawberry Fields had the costumes made to order for your particular perverted fantasy. Any fucking fantasy your twisted little heart desired. Out of this entire erotic circus, there was one day where seven girls showed up dressed like Joe Perry with tits. No one got laid that night. Penny Lane, the groupie Kate Hudson played in Almost Famous, could easily have been based on sweet... Hell, I'm not even going to give the girl a pseudonym, but that was her, my girlfriend-to-be, one of the six girls in the Little Oral Annie Club we met that night. She was 16. She knew how to nasty, and there wasn't a hair on it. With my bad self being 26 and she barely old enough to drive and sexy as hell, I just fell madly in love with her. She was a cute, skinny little tomboy dressed up as Little Bo Peep. She was my heart's desire, my partner, and crimes of passion. Early on in the band, when I was still young and easily Freudened, I'd blurt out my sexual fantasies. I thought I was just being honest and saying what was on everybody's mind, but I made the mistake of talking this stuff in front of the band's wives. You know, stuff like how I'd like doing it with two girls, twins, preferably.
"You're disgusting, Steve,"
one of the band wives blurted out. I hate it when people call me Steve. Always a tinge of squinge attached to Steve. I'd say, "What? Boys don't like threesomes? Don't all boys dream about that?" And did I expect my bandmate to say, "Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, baby. That is my secret fantasy. And, honey, while Steven's brought up the subject of sexual fantasies, did I ever tell you I've always wanted you to dress up in a Nazi uniform and order me to goose step on your great white plane?" What was I thinking?
No man is going to tell his wife what he really likes, because when he gets home, she'll Lorena Bobbitt his ass and he'll never find his licorice nib again. Any cop will tell you that the things people lie about most are sex and drugs, and in that order. So hypocrisy is the order of the day. I would just sit there, flabbergasted, going, oh, really? You mean boys don't like girls going down on each other? I think I'm on firm theoretical grounds in saying this, but I always welcome other points of view. Of course, nowadays, in every fuck club or strip joint, it's fashionable, hell, it's mandatory, for two girls to kiss and jam out with their clam out. Why did it take so long? That's how they get your attention. Now they know. Can I help it if I was ahead of my time? Back then, I used to say, oh, come on, all guys like a close shave. In the year 2011, it's become fashionable for girls from 16 to 60 to be cut to the quick. It's waxed, smacked, and shellacked. Do we need to do a survey? They may have a landing strip, so flight attendants, please remain seated until my face comes to a complete and full stop. I remember one night on the road when Joe and I were sharing a bed with two girls and woke up in the morning with a seafood blue plate special. Crabs, four. Everybody! And I'm the last guy on the planet to use that little Barbie doll comb that used to come with a bottle of A200 that would burn the critters out. At one point, I had so many crabs, I used to say goodnight to them. My little oral Annie came back with me to the hotel, the Edgewater Inn in Seattle, where we sat in the tub for 2 hours, naked, with no water. When it dawned on me, there was an emergency cord in the bus we'd taken to the hotel. So I went down, on my way knocking on Ted Nugent's door, cut the cord with a pair of pliers I had in my bag, brought it up to my room, attached a fish hook from hell to it, ordered ham sandwiches, which is all you get after midnight, put the ham on the hook, and dropped it out the window. We pulled up mud sharks and codfish for the next 4 hours and proceeded to clean the fish and gut the two sharks. Then Ted says, check this out, and lays the two hearts on the sink. Okay, now go to bed, orders the madman. Next morning, my phone rings and it's Ted. Steven, go into the bathroom and check out the heart. I touch the sea critter with my finger, and I'll be damned if the heart didn't start beating. 9 hours later, which only proves one thing, which I can't remember just now. You can't kill a lawyer. Could that be it? Nugent suggested we have a fish fry at the gig, so we filleted the cod we caught, put him in a cooler, and took him to the gig that night with us. I offered him my crabs, but he politely declined. I was so in love, I almost took a teen bride. I went and slept at her parents' house for a couple of nights, and her parents fell in love with me, signed papers over for me to have custody, so I wouldn't get arrested if I took her out of state. I took her on tour with me. My sweet E, standing in front just shaking your ass. Take you backstage, you can drink from my glass. Talk about something you can sure understand, 'cause a month on the road and I'll be eating from your hand. That was her. I lived with her for 3 years. She was a sweet, mysterious creature, very smart, and she knew what she liked and what I liked. We took baths together. She wore skirts with no panties. We did it on the red eye from L.A. to Boston, that kind of stuff, all the things that guys dream about. We made love in public, in private, and tried positions the Kama Sutra has yet to come up with. One time we started out in a hot tub on the roof and wound up in the lobby. We got out of the hot tub naked and into the elevator and dared each other we couldn't make it all the way down to our room without being seen. We hit every floor, starting with the lobby. Unfortunately, it went there first. It was so erotic and romantic that by the time we got to the lobby, we were coming and going all at the same time. When the doors opened, there was an Amish family staring at us like figures in an oil painting. The door closes. Then it opens again, and someone says, can I have your autograph? That sweet girl used to recite poetry and constantly sing songs to me like my mother did when she put me to sleep. It was an inspiration to my heart. One of the songs she taught me was We Are Siamese, which I'm sure you'll all remember from the movie Lady and the Tramp. Like I said, so sweet. Not like me. At the end of the tour, I brought her home to Boston. We got on well for a while. We were best friends and did everything together. She even knew how to mow a lawn. That impressed me. There's a picture of us in People magazine sitting on my tractor, but toward the end, things started to derail. We got so messed up on drugs and were so out of control that the dark side started taking over. And while I was on the road, our apartment